This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about sectioning and hospitalization with returning guest Karen Manton. She's a writer and mental health activist who previously was on the podcast to talk all about bipolar. Before we get into the interview, I wanted to start off with a definition of the law behind sectioning. The Mental Health Act of 1983 is the main piece of legislation that covers the assessment, treatment, and rights of people with a mental health disorder. People detained under the Mental Health Act need urgent treatment for a mental health disorder and are at risk of harm to themselves or others. So I thought that was a good place to start with the NHS definition of sectioning. Is there anything you wanted to mention on that so far, Danielle?
I think it's a good definition. It covers it, what I thought it might, what it might mean and what it is. I think that's hits the nail on the head.
Mm-hmm. So up next, we've got a few stats. These are from NHS Digital. So in a study they carried out between 2017 to 2018, these are a few of their key findings. 49,551 new detentions under the Mental Health Act were recorded, but the overall national totals will be higher as not all providers submit data. It is estimated that there was an increase in detentions of 2.4% from the previous year. Any thoughts on those?
It's just so sad, isn't it? You know, 50,000 people nearly were detained. If I think that it's sad, you know, maybe it's great if you look at it from another point of view in that we have facilities and situations
that can provide that many beds, I guess. But we do know that there's such a stretch on those resources. And it mentions there that not all providers submit data. There's also, they're not going to be submitting data on the people they had to turn away.
Absolutely.
So we don't know how many more thousands might have been on that total but couldn't be.
What's concerning is also the fact that all of these people who are being sectioned, what happens next? Because that's the whole another story. That's the main, you know, that's what's so concerning, where they come when they're off their section. You know, then what happens to a lot of these people that don't have homes, like our guests, maybe to go back into, or families to slot back into, and are put in the community? That's where the beds are of shortage, and the support is just non-existent. Well, it's existent, but it's just not enough to support 50,000 plus people that get sectioned, you know, each year.
Absolutely. And that's something we talked to the guest a little bit about, isn't it? That there's one particular occurrence where she was pretty much just put out on the side of the road at a strange hour when her section ended. And, you know, that had a really detrimental effect on her mental health when she was supposedly meant to be well and ready to go back into the world.
Absolutely. And somebody in my family very recently came off a section, and again at 4:30 p.m. a phone call to say this person's coming out of hospital at 5:30. Okay, no plan in place. This is literally 2019, June, like no plan in place, nothing at all. So the house that the person had been living in for the last 5 years wouldn't take him back because of the circumstances in which he was sectioned 3 months earlier. So as a family, everybody's running around trying to find a home for this person. It's really close to my heart. You know, it's really difficult to talk about, but it's just been an absolute nightmare, you know, from being sectioned. And often people who are sectioned more than once.
That's a really good point you've made. And it is maddening to think that that's the case at this point, with all the progress that's been made towards understanding mental health better. There's still so far to go, because that's just so inappropriate. And I wonder if perhaps that might also be a sign of the stretch on resources, because surely no normal organisation is seeing that as acceptable to make a decision about someone being taken off section, or maybe just only think to notify the family an hour before. I wonder if maybe there could have been an emergency case that came in and therefore they thought, well, this person was going to come off section soon, we'll just do it a bit earlier.
Probably we thought exactly the same, and we also thought, and I'm not sceptical, I try and be really open-minded, the resources, as you said, are absolutely, you know, squashed. And people, organisations doing the best that they can, the NHS, they're doing the best that they can, the workers, the staff are amazing. But we actually thought maybe because they've seen this person get so much care from family, visiting every day, taking them out for meals, providing clothes every day, really being involved with the person's care whilst on the section, he was potentially the easiest one, like you said, to let go. You know, we get an emergency case in, oh, he could go because he's got the support, because they saw us being so supportive. That's absolutely how it felt. And maybe if you were the psychiatrist on that ward, would you make the decision too? It's really, really difficult, both sides of the coin.
Yeah. So whilst absolutely at any level of resources, improvements can still be made without spending further money, and there's some of the things we'll talk about a bit in the interview today, there's still, when the resources are limited to that extent, impossible decisions like that. So you might find yourself making these decisions based on what the family's like. Because if you just don't have enough beds, you're going to have to find some rationale.
Yes, some criteria.
Of who do we take out of this situation. But the crazy thing is, for you as a family member, you might then start thinking the logic of, oh, well, I'm not going to visit.
Yeah.
If it's going to impact the care he gets,
absolutely,
then it's incentivising you not to
imagine
support
that.
Him. And that's very much the case across the board with the kind of austerity cuts. We did an episode in February on politics and mental health, and we were talking a lot about cuts to the benefit system and how there's pressure to a certain extent for people to actively present as their worst in order to not get their benefits cut. That they might be having a good day, but just because they're having a good day and they're having an assessment that day, that may come across as they're better.
Yeah.
And they're not.
That's, you know, outrageous, really. But that's where we're at.
And that's it, that people are having to do that, because it can sound manipulative on the face of it, but really what you're trying to do is just present a normal day in your life. And so if most days you can't manage to do certain day-to-day tasks because of, let's say, disability and extreme mental health conditions, then you've got to show an example of your life, rather than if you're having a good day, you might be judged quite differently.
Yeah.
And that's, it's really sad that it's coming down to those like fine, like splitting hair decisions of who gets the limited money the government's giving out. And there's not an easy fix in that. But as we talk about in the episode, there is progress that's being made that our guest has seen. And there are things at the same time she could see improving so much more that don't always equate to further spending. So,
like character of care, character of the people that are caring for you, you know, working with people as human beings, which, as you said, doesn't cost if you recruit the right people in the first place. But again, that's a whole new story, so ignore that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I do agree. And I've got two more stats again from NHS Digital. So first up, known detention rates were higher for males by 8 people per 100,000 in the population than females. And the last stat is that among the 5 broad ethnic groups, known rates of detention of the Black or Black British group were over 4 times those of the white group.
I mean, you know, I could just talk about that all day. It's just such a thing. I've been asked so many times recently in different situations about this. You know, do black people seem to have worse mental health than non-black people? And it's just such a culmination of things. I think I wouldn't even like to start to get into it on this. It's such a, you know, a worrying stat. I think the gender thing isn't that, the gap's not so big. You know, black or black British, 4 times more likely, is very worrying.
Yeah. And that's exactly right. I think it's all the other factors outside of it, because it'd be easy to see statistics like that and think, okay, black males are the most likely to be sectioned, and that is actually true, but that's not the whole story. That doesn't mean they're the most likely to experience mental illness necessarily.
If you're born as a black male, it doesn't mean someone probably going to become mentally ill.
Yeah, you're not...
It's not a default.
You're not predisposed to that as a human genetically, but you may be to some extent predisposed in the way our society runs. There's certain stigma that can affect some groups more than others. And equally, we've explored in other episodes how certain ethnic minority groups do receive more discrimination, can receive less support, can be disproportionately disadvantaged socioeconomically. And so all of these factors, whilst they're not necessarily all direct, do have an influence.
Yeah.
For me, that brings up a lot of thoughts of previous episodes where we've talked about gender and mental health. Some of the stats we looked into there was how men often present at the GP far later when their symptoms are far further advanced, and so may need to go down a sectioning route, whereas had they had earlier intervention, that could have been prevented.
Yeah.
And so these things all play into factors in a national set of statistics like this.
Well, absolutely. And the environment and also cultural factors that play a part. And I just think that it's really important that we start to ask the questions why, and that we need to be careful when we look at some of these statistics, and, you know, they need to be put really into context. Saying all that, there is an issue. The family member that I'm talking about is a black male, and you come out of a hospital and you're put in a house in the most deprived area with all other young black males who are also come out of hospital off sectioning, and there's drugs and there's just all sorts going on all around the place, and you've got an option of three houses, three beds, and they're all in an area that's within, you know, half a mile of each other, and they're all exactly the same. That there's not really much hope and much support to bring you out of that environment that potentially put you in hospital in the first place. But hopefully, you know, forever the optimist, hopefully things will change. And with our podcast and bringing awareness and reducing stigma, hopefully we can keep making a difference.
Yeah, times are changing, but that doesn't mean it's any less important to keep revisiting stats like this, to remind ourselves why it's so important, this kind of work, and the progress that's still needed. And so I'm really glad to be covering this episode all about sectioning, something that is a very sensitive topic, something that everyone has an opinion on, seemingly whether you've experienced being sectioned or not. So it's really great to hear from our guest who's been through that experience a few times and learned a lot about what good care looks like.
She was great. And I think people like that need to be advising our policy, because she actually hit the nail on the head, which the listeners will hear, but she knew exactly. And you're right. People like Karen, who have been through these situations and then come out and live their lives and thrive. And, you know, she's become a writer, hasn't she? You know, can really give back and really help progress.
Absolutely. And I'll save it for in the interview, but there is a really great thing we end on in terms of work she's doing now to help really make a difference and make the most of what she's learned. So that's everything from us for the intro. We'll get into the episode with Karen Manton in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name's Karen Manton, and I first had my taste of mental illness at about the age of 17. There was various reasons. I'd only started full-time work, and that was the trigger due to, should we say, a bit of bitchiness going on in the office and various other things. And I was also in a full-on relationship which was breaking down. So with a combination of the two things, I was finding it difficult to sleep at night. And I would say that was the very first symptom that I had, the lack of sleep. I thought it would only be a few hours, as anybody does. It went into an actual full night without a wink of sleep. And then that full night then turned into the second day, the third day. And as each day went on, I was still struggling to get into work. And then it wasn't until everything sort of started to go wrong at work. I couldn't function. I'd be throwing important invoices in the bin instead of paying them. And lots of things started to go downhill from there, really. And it was then that we decided I had to go and see my GP. There was nothing else that could be done because this was just not normal behaviour. And my sleep pattern wasn't going to come back anytime soon. Went to see the GP and I got pretty frustrated. I think I just wanted him to take all this away from me, which wasn't going to happen. He gave me some antidepressants and I got a bit angry because I don't think I could understand what was going on in my own mind and why I was behaving the way I was. Subsequently, I took the tablets, I stopped them, I started them. And it was kind of a reluctance to agree that this was going to make me better. So I was quite poorly for quite some months, really. Mm-hmm. And it was only called anxiety and depression. That was all we had.
And so if I remember rightly as well, these symptoms kind of escalated quite quickly, didn't they? From you first experiencing them to then going to the GP. And yeah. You were in quite a distressed state, partly because of the lack of sleep as well, when you got to that point, right?
That's right. I mean, anyone can cope with a few hours and the odd night, but this was just, as I say, it must have been about a full 6 or 7 nights before we actually thought, this isn't going to get any better. And I think it was Mum that convinced me we had to go and see the doctor because he was the only one who was going to be able to, I suppose, get me back on the right path, really. I do recall he did a referral to a psychiatrist at that point. And I think that was when I just had the one visit to him. He didn't really say an awful lot to me. He couldn't diagnose me again. It was just anxiety and depression. He would ask me a few questions and then before I knew where I was quickly put back into the system, really. And as I say, it's all started in about the April time, back end of April 86. And it was to be September, October of that year, before I could say that I was starting to feel more like my normal self, really. So it was quite a while, that first episode.
Yeah. And the initial antidepressants you took, did they have much effect? Because it turned out to be bipolar you were experiencing, and so you were being given antidepressants based on what wasn't ultimately an accurate diagnosis.
That's right, and I think it was only, they maybe did help me to get my sleep pattern. I probably was given some sleeping tablets at the time as well. So I think when we got the sleep pattern rectified, that probably started the brain thinking a little bit more normal, if you like. But as I say, it took quite some time because those tablets, as you say, were the wrong ones, really. And yes, I was feeling low because obviously I'd split up from my boyfriend and I was sat at home and I didn't want to go anywhere. So there was depression there. But because we couldn't get right into the actual, I suppose, the correct diagnosis, really, we knew that wasn't going to be the end of it. It was quite a battle. Mm-hmm. As I say, it was quite a battle. It took quite some time. And then it was sort of the back end of the year when I felt more like me, as I say, September onwards. And then I got on with it really from sort of being 17, 86 till about 92, when things went drastically wrong again.
Mm-hmm. And so did you feel there was anything in particular that led up to things getting so bad that second time?
Yeah, I knew exactly what the second time was. As I talk about quite openly in my book, I'd had a termination the previous year, various reasons. My husband and I didn't feel, my husband-to-be, it was just 6 weeks before my wedding and we didn't feel that the timing was right, being that I hadn't long since had a breakdown and I was trying to get back to some sort of normality, really. I had my grandmother dying and there was lots of things that made me make that decision. But come January of 92, I think the realisation was that it wasn't actually the right decision for me because at that time I felt that I would have had my baby and then I started to have all these weird symptoms. I actually went on to have a phantom pregnancy and it was then again that things were realised that, uh-oh, she's poorly again. So you see, they called the ambulance, which I willingly got into an ambulance because in my mind I was having all the symptoms of this phantom pregnancy.
So for the listeners, if they don't know what a phantom pregnancy is, that's where you believe that you are pregnant and it can even be as real as you having certain pregnancy symptoms.
Yeah, it starts, obviously the brain tells your body that that's what's happening and you literally do feel that your tummy's rising. I can recall all of that where you think some sort of miracle must have happened and, you know, you are going to... I think it's something that you probably desperately psychologically want, and so you manage to manifest the body into thinking that, and obviously the brain's there with it thinking this is going to happen by some miracle. So, of course, I willingly got into the ambulance thinking I was going to have my baby. The paramedics didn't, I don't think they tried to tell me anything at that point.
Right.
And to be fair, they were really lovely, affectionate, caring. They sort of would play along with that to get me to the hospital, because I would imagine if they tried to tell me otherwise, they wouldn't know what the reaction was going to be. So while we were in the hospital, I was already having hallucinations. I was seeing like flashings going on in the sky, and the brain was really, really full on with having, I suppose it was part of the psychosis, which we didn't know. And they were absolutely lovely with me. But it was arriving at the hospital and I was led into a room. I now know I was with a consultant, as in psychiatric consultant. But I thought at the time she was asking me all these questions about me, because in some way this was brilliant and this was a miracle unfolding and I was going to have this baby. But of course, obviously, the reality was she was trying to find out what was going on in the brain.
Right. So even during that initial kind of exploration of treatment, you were still relating it all back to this phantom pregnancy and thinking it was all about the baby.
Absolutely. You couldn't have told me any different. I was convinced that this was going to happen. So I spent some time with her and then I was led on to a ward. But it was what happened after that that was absolutely horrific. There was about five nurses, five members of staff that all came round the bed. And instead of somebody sort of being gentle and caring with me, you know, perhaps make me a cup of tea and trying to talk to me somehow, they wanted to get the medication in. And I suppose I can kind of even understand that. But it was the brutal way that they went about it, where they actually pinned me down to a bed and started shouting at me that I wasn't pregnant and that there was no baby there. And because with such force, all these five people were pushing me to a bed, getting the medication injected into me, I then had a full-blown grand mal seizure, which was really, really frightening. Yeah. My ex-husband was there and it was horrific to watch. It was really, really brutal, the way that treatment. Well, I don't know what to call it really, but it was horrible.
Mm-hmm. And prior to that many people approaching you to restrain you, what was your kind of mood like? How were you being towards the staff?
I was obviously excited and elated because I thought I was laying down on the bed to prepare for the oncoming labour. But of course, when you hear then everybody shouting, don't be silly, that's not a baby, you're not having a baby, that's really distressful. And I'm sure there could have been a far better way of trying to tell me that. There could have been a far better way than feeling the need to actually restrain me, and especially five members of staff, which in that, with the fear, I did actually lash out at one of them and I broke her glasses. But what people didn't understand, that was the fear of the way out. Not the fear because I wasn't having a baby, the fear of the treatment that I was receiving.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that's so hard to wrap my head around. Luckily, practices have improved since that being quite a few decades ago. But even within its own context, it doesn't make sense that through the process of someone being sectioned and then being considered a risk to themselves and others as part of that kind of rationale of sectioning someone, force can be used at times, but it's always meant to be when is appropriate. And with you being relatively calm and in fact more excited as opposed to aggressive, it seems a really odd approach that level of force was used so early on, because I imagine had a bit like the ambulance team, had they just kind of not confronted your delusions in that moment and instead just giving you the medication, you probably would have just taken it, I imagine, because you'd think, well, I need to look after me and the baby. I'll take the medication.
Yeah. That's right. There would have been a far better way. As you say, to all intent and purpose, I would have thought that the meds they were giving me was to relax me ready for the birth. So why not go about it that way than wanting to get an injection into you, screaming that you're not pregnant? And as I say, the fear of that brought about that huge, massive epileptic fit, which is titled, its professional title is a grand mal seizure. Mm-hmm. And then there was blood dripping down my mouth. I'd gone unconscious. And was there really a need for that? You know, did that have to be done? It's pretty shocking.
Yeah, clearly such a traumatic experience. And particularly when you were in the fragile mental state that you were in and you believed you were carrying a child. Well, that only adds to it as well, because then you've got all the fear around the baby as well.
Yeah. As I say, it was quite something. And that at that point, that was my first taste of sectioning. Believe it or not, it only lasted 7 days. But the irony was, at the end of the 7 days, they decided that they would let me go home at 8:30 at night and just kind of opened the door and sent me packing. And I had to go and look for a taxi. So sectioning just didn't seem to add up at that point. You section someone for the safety and then kick them out the hospital at 8:30 into the night on their own to get home.
And I imagine even at that point you must have been on some relatively heavy medication as well with the level of treatment you needed.
I'm not even sure whether the meds were continued at that time.
Oh, right.
I have no recollection of me, you know, remaining on them, because, as I say, I was sent home that time of night. I can't imagine I had even any meds to go home to. I felt as though in that week they'd kind of got a bit sick of me and, well, we'll just let her go. So it wasn't a very nice first experience of sectioning.
No, of course. And looking back on that now, what point in that, if at any point, did you come to terms with what you'd been through in terms of the psychosis and the delusions around the phantom pregnancy?
Yeah, I think, again, it's all about members of staff, because the very next day when things were a lot calmer, she would come and talk to me. And she told me I was having like a bit of a breakdown. And I understood her telling me that things had gone wrong. And because she had such a nice nature and a nice manner about her, I totally got her. She was very direct, but in a very, very nice way.
Mm-hmm.
And it is all about your manner and how you speak to people. And you can get so much out of a person by using kindness rather than going immediately for some sort of brutal force. It's about time people remembered you're still a human being, and that's so important, because the following sections really didn't get an awful lot better.
Yeah, no, that absolutely makes sense what you've said there, and that's very much considered the best practice techniques that I've read up on recently, in that you need to give people the chance that if, you know, someone does become aggressive or they're going to harm themselves or someone else around them, then there are times when a certain amount of restraint is necessary. But the approach and the best practices are very much considered to be, that's got to be reactive. And so that's what's so shocking about what you'd been through, that these people were meeting you for the first time and they straight away jumped to this conclusion that you needed such a level of force. It's maybe different if someone has a history of being harmful towards others, and that's the kind of thing that can be known in these situations. But to come at you with that approach when you hadn't got that is just surreal to me.
That's it. You see, that's the whole point. We hear about whether you are a danger to yourself or a danger to other people when this force of restraint is used. But this has never been the case with me when I've been in hospital. I found that I've been injected with the medication via force. If I've been reluctant to take the meds, which it would be far easier to sit down and find out what your fears are as to why you're reluctant to take it, than actually just getting someone to bend over while they inject the backside with force. And also, the only time that after that I was carried by 5 members of staff, I was frustrated this was on another section, and I ran to the door and tried to force open the door. And the only reason I was frustrated, I wanted to get out and get some fresh air, as I'd been kept in for about 3 weeks. Now, that's frustration, and there is certainly no need when someone's that upset to use five members of staff to carry them to a bed and force an injection on them. You have to find out why that person is frustrated. You know, there's no reason, unless that person is actually, as you say, threatening to be a danger to someone around them, there is no reason to use such force. We would have had another member of staff who was absolutely amazing, who would have just said, come on, we'll have a cup of tea, we'll go for a walk in a minute, and that's all it would have taken. But I can count on one hand the nice, caring members of staff that I met in the whole time that these sections took place. And that's where things drastically need to change.
Yeah, absolutely. And with that specific example, it's makes so much sense when you actually have the time like you do now to explain your frustration, because I can't imagine anyone that wouldn't be frustrated not being allowed fresh air after being in for 3 weeks. I can also see it from both sides, in that the nature of you being on a secure ward, there are limitations to that. But I think overall, this is why it's so key that there's proper levels of resourcing and funding to this kind of care, because when the staff are stretched and there's not enough of them, you can see how they're going to try and potentially get through as many people as possible and may not have the ability to take that time out with somebody one-on-one when they've got that many people on a ward that need their meds. And that's very much, like you mentioned earlier, the importance of treating people as human, that we have to have a certain amount of staffing and resources that if somebody is having a particular difficult day or is behaving differently, that there's someone available to look into that with them.
I have got crystal clear memories of what was going on in the hospital, and I feel really sorry because there was a lot of frustrated people like myself. Only when they try and make phone calls to, for instance, say the social worker, and that call's blocked, what the social worker and the people outside don't understand is we can see what's going on in the hospital, and that's what's desperately, desperately needed, is their interaction on that ward. Even if it's just sat, as one member of staff did regular, sat getting you to do a crossword, trying to bring the brain down, you know, calm the brain down. Watch a bit of a programme together. Have a look at a magazine together. And, you know, and I do appreciate we say about nurses being understaffed, but that isn't what I was seeing. I wasn't seeing that. I would see also other nurses coming. They would stand in front of you talking to each other. You have to remember, first and foremost, those people on that ward have had a breakdown. That's what they've had in one way or shape or form. The most very intelligent people are in that hospital. They've just had a breakdown. It can happen to you and it can happen to someone else. But don't ignore them. Interact. There was many people who would come on that ward and ask, could I be their nurse? And that was because I took time out to introduce myself, to show that I care. Mm-hmm. And that's what it takes. That really is so important, giving them an injection and telling them to go to bed. I mean, I was a nightmare patient in that I wouldn't go to sleep. I wouldn't during the day. I wouldn't take to my bed to give you all, you know, free rein. That, you know, that wasn't going to happen with me. So I think a lot of them did get frustrated. But you also had the very lovely staff who were quite happy when they come on. They seen you and it made their day as well to come and sit and talk to you. You are a human being, you know. I mean, I had children out there. Come and talk to me about your kids so I can talk to you about mine. I'm still a human. I'm still a mother. Just because I've had a breakdown, don't think I just need to be, you know, sat vegetating in a corner somewhere.
Absolutely. And I think that's very much a danger of institutionalisation in general. Because when you talk about that, it reminds me very much of the sort of us and them mentality that exists in prisons. And that can easily carry over into scenarios like this when you're also in a secure environment, albeit for different reasons. So did you feel that was very much brewing as well towards you and others, that they
absolutely
didn't see you just as the same?
Yeah, you've just hit the nail on the head when you said us and them. For example, the first section I went on the following day, I asked, could I make a cup of tea? Oh, yes, that's fine. So they went into the kitchen with me. Oh, no, not that cupboard. That cupboard is the staff cups. You can't have one of them. You've got to use one. You know, I mean, hang on a second. What's the difference between you and me? Don't treat me like that. I'm not a leper. You know, I've had a breakdown. I'm not a leper. I'm a very clean, you know, person. And that's something, those kind of things do stick out. And you would have, believe it or not, members of staff who did have a, when she was speaking about other patients, or them, I've got to do that, I've got to do it. The word them was used quite often. Oh, so are you sitting with them? And you just could tell this one person, it was in a derogatory manner. And when I look back, I think it's so cruel. You know, there for the grace of God, you might be in that situation, you know, this time 6 months or something. Would you like to be treated like that? And it just shows that loving and kindness and care just get people to open up. I found that I was interacting with so many people, like a lady who was in and out of there. I managed to get her to start and get her hair done, put her makeup on, things that just made her feel a little bit better while she was on the hospital ward. I mean, a friend of mine who was a nun, a sister, she'd come and see me and she said, oh, you're like a breath of fresh air on this ward. Even though obviously you've got your own issues, you're trying to cheer everybody up and talk to people as you would. But that's just natural instinct for me.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you've mentioned something else there that I think is really important, how being in that kind of environment can be dehumanising by default because you've lost certain rights under sectioning, like the right to freedom, the right to decide whether or not you're going to be taking the medication. And so it can already be dehumanising enough being in that environment, having your whole routine and your usual structure removed without you then being treated as some kind of different class of citizen to the people that are looking after you. Because that's
exactly, yeah, what it is, isn't it? It's that loss of freedom, and you're trying to come to terms with that. So while you're doing that, please, you know, at least show, regarding the staff, show people respect, because it's not their fault they've ended up in that position. You know, don't assume that they're any less intelligent than you. The usual reason is people have worn their brains out that much. That's why they end up ill. So don't ever assume that, you know, they're in a different league where intelligence is concerned, or, you know, just be respectful, I think, is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so how did you feel it compared, how the patients interacted compared to how the staff interacted with you?
I thought the patients were lovely. There wasn't any patients that I didn't get along with because I made an effort with everybody. But that would be frowned upon sometimes by staff, because I just don't think they like to see that you could interact that well with other people. So why they wouldn't want to see others come on and benefit from that interaction, I really don't get. But as I say, I mean, I'm not speaking for all the staff. As I say, but I can count on one hand the memories I have of, you know, the staff that were lovely and that did show they cared. And that took the time out. As I say, it might be a simple thing, like sitting with you, getting you to concentrate and help them with a crossword while you have a cuppa. That's all you want. It's about interaction. You know, this isn't their normal life. This is just what's happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the really key distinction, isn't it? That your patients are people you're there to care for as opposed to guard.
Further sections, when I'd have my ward rounds, I would always have some smart clothes brought up. That's me, and that's who I am. But believe it or not, because I went into that ward round in maybe like a suit, a nice jacket, skirt and jacket, I would be deemed as being grandiose. That was the term that was given to me. No, that is me. When I've left the ward round, I'll go and put my jeans on. But that is who I am. You shouldn't just make assumptions about people. Again, that's where you're wrong.
Yeah, and the irony of that is, to me, that sounds very healthy, that you were trying to kind of keep a normal sort of routine for you. You were bringing elements of your outside life in with you, and that seems quite healthy in your road to recovery anyway.
Right. We had a sister, and she was the most amazing person that hospital ever had, because she was always interacting and little things, like she'd get the hairdryer out for me on a morning, and she got to know me. She knew me as a person. I'd say to her, oh, should we get all the patients together this afternoon when we'll put, as it was back then, a video on, we'll put grease on. Oh, okay, Karen, you put the film on, I'll bring the chocolates in. And isn't that lovely? That's treating people in a nice, respectful, caring manner.
For sure. And it makes a lot of sense. It's really quite straightforward. If you had given up on grooming, if you weren't bothering to dry your hair or present yourself how you normally would, surely that's far more concerning than you having a little bit of support in terms of keeping your usual routine.
That's what you'd think, isn't it? That's exactly how I would feel if someone's trying to be their normal self, then, you know, that's a good thing. But often it was frowned upon. And as I say, the word grandiose was used more often than not. And it was recorded when I later looked at my record. It was recorded as, oh, she's being grand. No, she isn't. She's actually just being her. But you don't know the real her. And that's the problem. And you don't take the time to get to know that person.
Yeah, and it almost sounds like a kind of hierarchy thing, that some of those in charge almost saw you as getting above your station by taking more ownership of your life and your routine. You were somehow kind of acting out from being submissive. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It was the same as when it was pointed out when I was going over to the church, that why am I doing that? It was because it was the only thing I had to sort of hold on to, really. There was nothing else for me to, you know, it was a glimmer of hope, I suppose.
Yeah, that's really important, particularly on a ward of that nature when there'll be a high level of people feeling suicidal. Surely any hope they have to keep them present and finding things to stay alive for is to be absolutely encouraged.
It should be sort of commended, shouldn't it, rather than frowned upon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
With that specific example about you changing clothes for the ward round, were you given a reason why they thought that it would delay you getting off section for you to get changed?
No, and I suppose at the time you don't dare question that, really. Looking back now, you do wish, or you wish somebody could have said it for you, but you to ask that, I don't suppose you'd have been given a respectful answer to that. It was just you'd be seen as not grandiose, but if you are that person, you're not going to change for anybody. And you're not, I mean, why would you do it? You're not doing it to wind anybody up. You're doing it because it's how you would behave. If I was at home and I was going to an outpatient appointment, I would dress differently to how I would when I'm going out walking the dog.
Mm-hmm.
No, and that's how I would see it.
I feel like even if there was a legitimate reason, so if, for example, a lot of other patients had recently been dressing up to try and seem like they were more ready to be taken off section than they were, then if that was the case and you'd been given that rationale, then you'd at least understand. But it sounds like there probably wasn't any rationale in this case.
No, it was just a comment, and I think you're just seen by certain members of staff, as you said, it's as though you're trying to go above your station, but that isn't the truth, you know. I mean, some nurses were lovely, and one in particular, he will always stay in mind, and he knows who he is. He's just fantastic. He's retired now, and he would make a joke and put my high heels on the fireplace ready for me to say, come on, Karen, we're ready for your next wardrobe. But that would make me giggle, and that was just being lovely and making me laugh, and he knew how to do that, as a few other members of staff did.
Right, well, it's that difference between treating you as an individual.
It certainly is, and you will get the best out of the patient as well when you show them respect. I would notice that when these certain members of staff on, there wasn't any frustrations and sort of aggro, really, arguments and things, because everybody was quite chilled because they were giving off that feeling. And if you give that off, you're going to make everyone else feel nice and relaxed, and there's not going to be that need. And when anything did sort of kick off, if you like, he would know how to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And other members of certain members of staff would just know how to sort of bring everything to a calm again without the need for injections. I mean, I discussed it with day staff, what would happen to me some nights, and they weren't surprised when I mentioned who these members of staff were. They knew that that is how they behaved, when a simple cup of tea would calm you down. Don't get me wrong, if you've gone in and it's full-blown psychosis, there is that need for the meds, of course there is, to bring you down and to get you on an even keel, but not when you're getting more settled. You know, judge it by how that person is. Don't just bang an injection into them just because you feel like doing it.
Right, for sure. And that lack of consistency as well can affect you so much. When all these other people are in charge of your life and your routine, then when the rules are constantly changing, it's going to be difficult to feel safe and better. And you've also mentioned something else there that I think is really important, in that the importance of having personalised care. And I know there can be concerns around that in terms of certain institutions, in that they're very cautious of being seen to show favouritism, and perhaps that's part of what holds people back from caring for people as individuals and not a kind of one rule for all system, which I don't agree with, but maybe that's the rationale. But like we've discussed many times on the podcast, mental health, and particularly mental health recovery, varies for everyone. You've got to kind of find your own formula to become healthier and to stay healthy. And it sounds like that was something you were really lacking.
Yeah, because I mean, those days when it would always be on the board who was going to be your nurse or your nursing assistant, and you would always look for those certain names because you knew there was going to be a good day ahead. But when it wasn't those names and it was someone that you knew was going to clash with you and not try and interact with you, that really has a massive impact on where you're going. So for me, a good formula is, if a person is showing progress with certain members of staff, work on that. Because isn't that the ultimate aim? Don't we want people out of hospital faster and, recovered? Having said that, I mean, I think these days it's probably harder to get in than it is to get out, as it was back in my day, from what I'm, the information I'm getting on other people now.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is a lot of the lack of funding that's so desperately needed. Mm-hmm. And it can vary. Hopefully my producer Pete won't mind me mentioning he works in a medium secure unit as another job separate to this. And I've known of cases where they've got him to do overtime or to potentially change shifts in order to support particular patients that have responded really well to him, or feel more comfortable with him. And that absolutely makes sense to me.
See, and that again, we are talking different levels of illness. Those people will need handling, I would imagine, very differently because of the violent tendencies. Well, you have to remember that the hospital ward I'm on should have just been an open ward where, yes, there is sectioning going on, but it's sort of just on a mental breakdown level. Or you might have someone who's struggling to get off alcohol or, to give up some vice, and that's why they're in there. We're not talking people who've assaulted, we're not talking that scale. So it's treatment each to the level of illness that person is at. I mean, I would sometimes see a chap who worked in there who belonged to the secure unit, but is that a right cover of jobs? Because what he's dealing with the majority of his time is entirely different to a lady who's perhaps had a baby, has a bit of postnatal depression. We're talking way different extremes here, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And the training and the severity of response would be so different depending on the level of security. And so we are coming near the end of our time at this point, and you shared some really good insight on your experience. Do you feel there are a few things you could summarise, or any big takeaway you'd like to mention on how you see sectioning being improved?
Yeah, I mean, I have already discussed some things with mental health today. I was asked what I thought about having a representative for those times when you may get ill and you may be sectioned or you may need hospital. Who's going to be your, if you like, your spokesperson? And I believe that is being brought in or already has, yes, where you can already have a named person. And that is important because that named person has to be somebody that you ultimately trust. You know, you trust completely in the outside world. So you know if it comes to this, they are going to do the very best that they can for you, rather than maybe a family member that you might not even have a good relationship with, you might not trust. So I think having that named person is key to your welfare, really. Going on from that, I'm going to be starting work at my local uni in September, which I'm delighted about. And part of that is going to be going on the interview panels for nursing students. So in that way, I'm going to be able to ask the questions that I want to ask based on how I've been treated as a service user, in the hope that we can make sure the staff of, you know, our future are going to have that caring, understanding nature and are not going in there to sort of be on a power trip as unbelievably some are. You know, we ultimately need that care before anything else. We need that care of people. And I can't express that word enough. Mm-hmm. If you care about someone, you're going to have their best interests at heart.
Absolutely. And that is so key, because in the most extreme cases, when people are sectioned, it's because they have no ability to know what is best and safest for them. And so you need, in lieu of that person being able to make decisions for their well-being, like you described there, ideally as a combination of mental health professionals that have that caring and that investment in supporting people as best they can, coupled with people having a designated spokesperson, like you describe it, someone that can keep an eye on their affairs inside of and outside of that sectioning environment.
That's right. I mean, I discussed when I had a CPN that the problem is you'll have this package of care outside of hospital, i.e. you've probably got a designated, you know, psychiatric nurse, community psychiatric nurse, as I did. But when you go into hospital, you lose all these people. Right. You lose them. But it's important for that to continue, because that nurse, you have to remember, you'll have opened up to that person. So if you go on the ward and then that person comes along, you will have gained, you know, they will have gained your trust. So you will want them to sort of speak up for you. So let's not have a divide. Let those members of, you know, your care team go into the hospital with you.
Yeah.
Because they will know you better than anyone else as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. That's a good place to round up. And so if people want to learn more about you and read your brilliant book all about your experience of bipolar, where should they find your book?
Searching for Brighter Days is available on Amazon. It's currently on sale as well. So yeah, if you want to read a little bit more about what I've been through, but not only what I've been through, how I've learned to take control of my life, then I would suggest maybe you want to give it a read, and you just might find it helpful to you.
Great. Yeah, it is really brilliant, and it's a great insight into bipolar, a condition that I feel is still often misunderstood. And if you want to hear more of this podcast and Karen, we did the previous episode all about the theme of bipolar, that you can find if you scroll right back. It's one of our earliest episodes of the podcast. Grand. So that was everything to mention for now. Thank you again so much for being on the show again. It's been great to catch up with you.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Of course.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.